The castes are compared to the limbs of a body. The Brahmin caste, the head. The Kshatriya, or governing caste, the shoulders and arms. The Vaishya, or third estate, the wealthy caste, the torso. And the serving caste, the Shudra, the legs. Now, what would happen to a body if the feet said, I want to be the head, or the head said, I want to be the heart, or, you know, what do we call that when it happens in a body? We call it cancer. And so what we call democracy is, from this standpoint, cancer. There is, however, a very special occasion when the caste differentiations can be transcended, and that is occasion of certain kind of worship when one goes past caste. That means in one's mind one has gone past the realm of Maya altogether and united oneself with the transcendent power. Now let me speak very briefly, and I want to do this, brief though it must be, as a kind of preparation for the slides for next week, the historical evidence we have for the development of these ideas in India. First, the Indus Valley civilization. Two considerable cities, very much like the cities in Crete, geometrically laid out, appear in India about 2500 BC. Obviously, implantations. They did not grow there. They were brought in from the Iranian plateau, and obviously also for the exploitation of a very rich land, a land very rich in natural resources. Within these cities, and they were pretty darned materialistic, they're just laid out in a very mechanical way. There's very little art. There are a few tiny little images in contrast to the magnificent art of contemporary Egypt, Mesopotamia, and Crete. This is rather slight. A few little images, but most important, a number of seals, about an inch and a half square for sealing documents. And it's on these seals that certain little bas-reliefs tell us of the imagery of this period. The most conspicuous figure on these seals is the bull. The same bull that you see walking around the streets of Calcutta today. It is that sacred bull who is the consort of the goddess Cow. This is the goddess, and this is the bull whom we know from India, from Egypt, from Mesopotamia, and from Crete. This is the bull that in Egypt is identified with Osiris, the god who dies and is resurrected, the Apis bull, who represents that energy of life, that divine procreative energy of life that brings forth forms. The horns of the bull, I'm speaking now from the standpoint that we can arrive at through comparative study of these contemporaneous cultures, the horns of the bull are equated with the horns of the moon. And the moon is that sign in the sky of death and resurrection beyond death, the eternal recurrence. The moon remains the high symbol of the dead and resurrecting God. Even in the Christian image, Christ is 3 days in the tomb, the moon is 3 days dark, and the dating of Easter is always made in relation to the full moon. The moon can also be thought of as a cup which fills with ambrosia. In the tropical world, the sun is fierce and burning and desiccates the vegetation. The night moon sends down the dew, the ambrosia, the amrita, the drink of immortality which refreshes life. And this is equated with the vital energy of the bull. So that the bull and the moon, and the moon may be thought of as a cup. You see it fill every month and then unload its ambrosia on the earth and fill again. Furthermore, the moon sheds its shadow, just as a serpent sheds its skin. And so the serpent sloughing its skin and the moon sloughing its shadow are equivalent. We have the moon, we have the bull, we have the serpent. These are equivalent symbols. And that serpent is exactly the serpent of the Kundalini that we brought up the spine last week. Against the moon, you have the sun, which represents that fierce, burning, fiery power. And the animal equivalent to the sun is the lion, whose wonderful face is the solar face, and he pounces on the bull just as the sun does on the moon. And the bird associated with the sun is the eagle or the hawk, who pounces on the serpent as the sun pounces on the waters. These are prime images that come back and forth. Shiva has the moon in his hair, and Vishnu is shown on the serpent, but Vishnu is also shown flying on the sunbird Garuda. These are symbols that are already indicated in the ancient Indus culture. Also, there are Lingam Yoni symbols from there. Also, there is the symbol of a tree with a certain specific kind of leaf, a kind of heart-shaped or spade-shaped leaf. That is the leaf of the Bodhi tree, the tree under which the Buddha sat, which in Buddhism is called the immovable point, that center point, that hub around which the whole ever-proceeding vortex revolves. Finally, we have one sign in the Indus Valley world that does not appear in the West, and that is a number of seals showing a yogi, a seated yogi. These date from about 2000 BC and are, as far as our archaeological evidence goes, the earliest signs of a yogi that we have. What is the origin of this? Who knows? In the Indus culture world, there are two great racial groups. One is the group that came in from the Western zone, sort of Mediterranean type, and the other is the Australoid race, the race that can be traced all the way from northwest India right back down through South India out into the Indians, into the islands of the Pacific in a big broad way. It may well be that this yogic attitude comes from shamanistic principles going way, way back. At any rate, the evidence fades out there in darkness. All of these elements in the Indus culture survive in popular Hinduism to this day. The notion of the ever-evolving world, the world against which there's no use fighting, acquiescence, acquiescence, acquiescence in the laws of a universe that are given from a source that cannot be touched, and the imagery of this still point and yoga and so forth. Against this, about 1500 BC, there comes a totally new race. These are the Aryans. They are of exactly the same period as Homer's Aryans entering into Crete. There is a precise parallelism here. They bring many of the same divinities, the same heroic attitude. These are the people who invented the war chariot, drawn by two powerful horses. It's at this moment that the horse appears in history, and he gives to these men a terrific fighting power so that they're not acquiescing in the will of the universe. They found a will in themselves, and they are showing it. Anything they want, they can get. And they have their shamans, their magicians, their Brahmins, who, with their rites, can cause the gods to do what is wanted. Now, when you have settled people, as you had in the earlier culture, trading people and planting people, you have divinities who can be worshipped in this specific rock, this specific tree, this specific lake or pond. With the great ranging nomads, you have divinities who are everywhere. The broad stretching earth, the overarching heavens, the winds, the sun, and so forth. And these are the gods of these Vedic Aryans, very much like the gods of the Homeric Greeks. This is the period also, by the way, of the invasions of Canaan by another warrior race, the Semites from the Syro-Arabian desert. And just as in the Bible, so with these Aryans, the powers of the soil, the fertilizing powers, and the people who worship them are despised. What are revered are the lords of the thunderbolt and the warrior arm. The words in the Old Testament, cities that you did not build, you shall inhabit. Fields that you did not plant, you shall reap, are words that befit these warrior people who do not cultivate the soil, ask Mother Earth to bring forth, but evoke and invoke the god of thunder and weaponry. And their rites have to do with the triumph of their race over the people whom they are invading. Now, the Brahmins would build their altars wherever they went in symbolic form. And then they would invoke the deities of the pantheon with hymns. And the principal divinity for the rite was the fire of the altar, called Agni, a word related to our word ignite. Agni was called the mouth of the gods. He is fed with the sacrifice. And the gods are then fed by Agni. And the gods then will cooperate with their human cousins and worshippers and give them the victory they seek. This is the mood of the Vedas. These hymns for invoking and giving power to man, invoking the gods and giving the gods power to man. The date for the Vedas, for the completion of the Vedas as we know them now, is about 1000 BC. And shortly following this, they're very much in the spirit of the Greek Homeric rites. Shortly following this comes a point, something the Greeks never developed, which is entirely Indian. The so-called Brahmanas, or the theological writings of the Brahmins. The thought that came was this. Since through our rites we can control the gods, therefore our rites are stronger than the gods. Therefore we are stronger than the gods. The power now is taken away from the pantheon and put in the hearts of those who from whom the pantheon stemmed. And there is a wonderful series of works, somewhat dry but extremely exciting in another sense, of comparison. The elements of the rite, how do these relate to the elements of the universe? How do these relate to the elements of the psyche? Universe, rite, psyche, they're all of one accord. And by manipulating the rite, we manipulate these forces. And then comes the final question, well, what is the nature of the rite? That will tell us the nature of the universe. And this is what the nature of the rite is. There is a fire. And into the fire is poured a sacrifice. That sacrifice is called soma. It is an intoxicating liquid, like the wine of the Greeks. It is pressed from a plant. That plant is refreshed by the dew of the moon. The moon is the celestial bull. It is as though you had the divine procreating energy of the bull caught here and were pouring it into the fire. Next, when you take food to your mouth and eat it, the fire in you consumes that food, just as Agni consumed soma. Therefore, eating food is a sacrifice. It is exactly the same as that other. And then you die, and you are thrown to the flames, either the flames of the funeral pyre or the flames of in the bellies of the worms, the vultures, or the hyenas. And you who were Agni now become soma. And then we come to this wild Dionysiac thought. The whole world is a sacrifice, a burning sacrificial fire, into which an inexhaustible divine sacrifice is poured forever. This notion of out of the death and burning comes life is a basic notion that underlies the great sacrificial rites in the Indian tradition. One step more now. Since that fire is within you, why bother with the Brahmins? Come into the forest, sit down, and seek it in yourself. And here comes then the great period of the Upanishads, which I believe can be safely said to be the most sublime religious writings in the world. They date from about the 8th century BC on. And what has happened? The idea of the yogi, which did not exist with the Hindus, with the original Aryans coming in, has now combined with the Aryan tradition. There has taken place an interaction between the two peoples, and a very deep new problem comes along. How do we coordinate these two ideals? the ideal of virtue, the ideal of the society, the ideal of work for the world, and this idea of yoga. The date for the Buddha, 563 to 483 BC, can be taken as the date of the climax and crisis of this conflict. The Buddha was not a Brahmin. He was of the Kshatriya caste, the second caste. And in the Upanishads themselves, we have texts, the earliest Upanishads, the Brihadaranyaka and the Chandogya, which show that the original Brahmins never knew anything about this. They got the doctrine from great kings. These are very interesting texts. One Brahmin goes to teach a king, and the king says to me, teach. But the king asks first, oh, then the Brahmin begins teaching, and the king says, oh, I know all that, I know all that, I know all that. Finally, the king says, he shows him a man asleep, and he speaks to the man asleep, and the man doesn't answer. Then the king kicks the man asleep, and the man wakes up, and the king says to the Brahmin, where was that man's understanding when he was asleep? And you get this doctrine of dream and deep sleep that I spoke of last week. It is from the natives of the land who were there before the Aryans came that these doctrines that we now revere as India's great doctrines really stem. The most crude, the most primitive and harsh of these yoga doctrines is that of the ancient Jain tradition. The great Jain teacher, Mahavira, was a contemporary of the Buddha. But he had been preceded by 23 other Jain teachers. The one before him, Parshvanatha, had lived probably in the 9th or 8th centuries BC. And before that, another and another. The Jain dates, like all Indian dates, are simply wild. They carry us back before the sun came into being. But anyhow, there's no doubt about it that this is an extremely ancient yogic tradition. And the aim of this yoga, now here's a very important point, is death. Literal death. But death before, death not before you have quenched in yourself or desire for life. If you kill yourself out of resentment or out of discouragement, you'll be back. You must have quenched everything in you. And the wonderful scheduling of vows so that you limit what you do stage by stage by stage until finally you limit the number of steps you'll take a day, the number of mouthfuls you'll eat, until finally you go out like a light. It's extraordinary. This is the prime religion of ahimsa, of nonviolence. Not to hurt any living thing, because the whole world is a living thing. You see, in Bombay, there are very few Jains left. They're around the Bombay Ahmedabad area. You see them wearing, like doctors are going to perform an operation, a kind of cloth in front of their mouths, not to breathe in little insects, or, furthermore, not to breathe the air in too hard, because then you'll hurt the air. If you fall into water, you don't swim, you'll hurt the water that way. Float ashore. Don't drink anything at night because there might be some little thing in it. Don't pluck fruit from the tree, that kills it. Wait for it to drop. And even that is really pretty crude, eating a fruit. Finally, you get so you don't eat anything, you just learn to consume the air, and you go out. The notion is that there are two principles, the soul and matter, and they are linked. And what you're trying to do is dissociate yourself entirely from it. Clean yourself of karmic matter and become a perfect bubble and float, rising to the top of the universe as a bubble dissociated from the world, and there remain for all eternity beyond this round. In contrast to that, there is the Buddhist doctrine, which is rather psychological than physiological. What is to die is the zeal for life, is the Maya commitment. Ignorance is what leads to desire. Desire leads to action. Action leads to deeper ignorance. Ignorance leads to desire. Desire leads to action. How do you get out of this? Well, you can attack it either in the way of attacking desire, or action, or ignorance. The principal Buddhist way is to attack the ignorance way. But you can also become inactive, or control your action, or you can also regulate your desire. Now I want to talk for about 10 more minutes on the yogas. These different ways of breaking this ring. The first yoga, called Raja Yoga, is the one I spoke of last week, which is really a psychological exercise for extinguishing in yourself these impulses and illuminating the body. I won't go through that anymore. A second order of yoga is called Jnana Yoga, the yoga of knowledge, viveka, of making distinctions. This is philosophical yoga. Not the exercise so much as the mental working out and making of distinctions. The basis is this: distinguish between the subject and the object of knowledge, and identify yourself with the subject. I am not my body. I know my body. I am not my body. I know my emotions. I am not my emotions. I know my thoughts. I am not my thoughts. You can drive yourself out the back of the room that way and simply identify yourself with the subject. And this is what you get in Sankhya. I am that pure subject of knowledge. And the Buddha goes one step further. The Buddha says, there's no subject of knowledge either. With that, you've gone past anything you can think. Then there comes the great yoga of devotion. This is the only yoga in which a god image is involved. And this will be any one of these gods I've spoken of, and your relationship to the god. And your relationship will be that of, basically, love. Now, there are five orders of love. The first, and simplest, and crudest, and that of most religious attitudes, is of servant to master. O Lord, you are the master, I am your servant. Say what I am to do, and I shall do it. This is the order of the normal religious devotee. Second is the order of friend to friend. In the Christian tradition, this would be the relationship of the apostles to Jesus. In the Indian imagery, it's the relationship of the Pandava brothers, the heroes of the Mahabharata, to Krishna, who was their friend. The third, and this requires a more developed spiritual person to be able to assume this friend-to-friend attitude toward the divinity, the inner companion, the divine friend. The third is the attitude of parent to child, where the God is the child. This is the attitude of the Christian at the Christmas crib, where the divine Lord is being cultivated in you. This is the Lord who's to be born in your heart and to be nourished there and brought to maturity. In the Indian tradition, it's the charming little stories of Krishna as a child, as they call him, the butter thief, that naughty little boy, beloved by everybody. His mother one day was told by a friend, little Krishna has been eating mud. And she goes out and slaps him and opens his mouth to take the mud out and clean his mouth. He played a trick on her. As she was gazing into his mouth, she saw the whole universe there. She didn't know who he had been up to that point. Her hair stood on end. And then he did her another favor. He wiped that recollection out so she should forget it. But the fourth level of love is that of husband for wife and wife for husband. This is the attitude in the Christian tradition of the nun to Jesus. She wears the wedding ring. She's the bride of Christ. And in the Indian tradition, it is the proper attitude of the wife to the husband. He is her Lord, and in her service to him, she is in service to God. With respect to this, I might say that since in the Indian tradition, the divine power is immanent in all things, you don't have to worship an imagined God. Anybody can be it. A woman came to Ramakrishna one time and said, Master, I'm sorry, but I can't love God. I don't. I can't say I do. Well, he says, is there nothing in the world that you love? And she said, I love my little nephew. He says, there you are. In your service to him, you're in the service to God. That matches also Krishna's advice to the cowherds who were singing praises to Indra, the Lord of Thunder. He says, what about the cows? Those are your support. Worship them. So the final order of love, what would that be? We've had servant to master, friend to friend, parent to child, husband to wife. The highest form of love is illegitimate love, illicit love. In marriage, you have the respect of the community. You have a job. You have life. But when you fall in love madly and furiously, so that everything is given up, everything's lost, reputation, everything else for love, that's love. And says Ramakrishna, when you love God that way and everything drops off, you can say, come through now. I've given everything for you. Show yourself to me. This brought about, this Vishnuistic idea of the ranges of love, quite a little series of moral discussions in the 11th and 12th centuries. The great example of illicit love is our Krishna after he grew up a little bit and began playing his flute in the woods of Vrindavan. And then all the young wives at night, first they would hear that flute in their hearts. Their hearts would open, then their eyes would open, then they'd look to see if their husbands were aware, and then they'd get up and sneak out to the forest. And then that wonderful dance took place, which became the principal topic of Indian devotional literature in the period that for us is the High Middle Ages. It's a very interesting thing. This literature came to culmination in a work by a young poet, Jayadeva, 1175, which is exactly the date for the flourishing of the Tristan and Isolde story in Europe. And these two traditions are of exactly the same essential sense, except that the contrast of East and West is very vividly present. The Indian is extremely lush, and Krishna dancing sometimes with 6,000 gopis at once, turning himself into 6,000 forms, is something a little more, well, mysterious, let me say, than Tristan moping in the wilderness for Isolde. Furthermore, in the Indian, there's always the religious mood. As to say, the woman becomes symbolic of a divine presence, whereas in the Western tradition, she is herself. There's no symbolism here. There's a secularity, a secular attitude, and a person-to-person attitude, which is very, very different. Finally, this brings up another point, that the Oriental religions ask us to go past virtue, to leave dharma, to leave virtue behind. They are metaphysically oriented, psychologically oriented. Our religions stress the ethical in a way that is transcended, actually, in the ultimate religious experiences of the East. So I've given three of these yogas now, the Raja Yoga and the what might be called psychological gymnastics, the meditative or contemplative or rather philosophical yoga of distinguishing between the subject and object, and the devotional yoga of the love for God. And now there's one more, and this is the great yoga of the Bhagavad Gita, the karma yoga. Briefly, these young five brothers, the Pandavas, had forfeited their kingdom in a gambling match. And they'd come back to claim it from their cousins who held it. And the two armies lined up on either side of the field were simply waiting for Arjuna, the leader of the Pandavas, to blow his war trumpet to start the affair. And Arjuna said to his chariot driver, who was his friend, Krishna, "Drive me out between the two lines so that I may have a look." And with the god as his chariot driver, he looks right and left, and he sees admirable men, friends on both sides. And suddenly what he was about to do overwhelmed him, and he dropped his bow, and he says to Krishna, "Better that I should die here than that I should precipitate this conflict." And Krishna said to him, "Whence this ignoble cowardice? Do you not realize you can't do anything? Those forms that you kill are mortal, but the immortal portion is untouched. What was never born never dies. Rains do not wet it, fire does not burn it," so forth, all those wonderful words of the Bhagavad Gita, the song of the Lord. Then he touches Arjuna's eyes, and Arjuna sees his friend suddenly transformed into Kala, the masculine form of Kali, black time, this terrific, majestic monster with many, many heads and tusked mouths, many weapons, and those two armies pouring into his mouths like grapes smashing there. And Arjuna's hair stands on end, and he says in trembling voice, "Who are you?" And he who had been his friend said, "I am Black Time, here for the licking up of the world. Those men whom you thought you were to kill are dead. Get in there and perform your function, your duty, your role as warrior, prince. Support the world in its process." Then he turns himself back to the charming Krishna again. Now the point is, of course, among other points, that we are all that Kala with all that inside us. Then he gives the instruction of how to act. And here's the formula. Act without fear or desire for the fruits of the action. Fear or desire either for yourself or for others, but simply proceed in the order of life. And since, as we pointed out last week, in the ultimate illumination, all pairs of opposites are transcended, are left behind. And this world, as we know and experience it, is the perfect lotus world. This is nirvana as it looks. These actions, whatever they are the actions of the divine power. This carries one step further. The actions of lust, the actions of pleasure are also yoga. And you have the formula, bhoga is yoga, delight is yoga. The whole world, as it lives, is a manifestation of this radiant mystery, and we do not see it. Now to conclude, let me just tell a little Indian animal story. Their stories are great, and they illuminate things like that. This is of a tigress. Some of you know this story, I'm sure. It was a favorite of Ramakrishna. She was pregnant and starving. She came upon a little herd of goats, and in her zeal she pounced too hard. The goats scattered, but she brought on the birth of her little one and died herself. The goats came back to where they'd been, and they had very strong parental instincts. They saw this tiny little just-born tiger with its dead mother, and so they adopted it. The tiger grew up thinking it was a goat. It learned to eat grass. It learned to bleat. It couldn't see itself in a mirror, so it didn't know that it wasn't a goat. Of course, grass isn't good for tigers, and so it was a pretty miserable specimen of its kind by the time it reached adolescence. And it was at that time that a great big male tiger pounced at the same little herd, and the goat scattered. But this thing, after all, was a tiger, and he was standing there. And the big fellow looked at him, and he said, "What? You living here with goats?" "Meh," says the tiger, and he nibbles a bit of grass. The big boy was mortified. What a shock to find his species in this condition. And he gives him a buffet or two and gets only these silly bleats. Then, desperation, he picks him up by the scruff of the neck and takes him to a quiet pond. Now, as I said last week, the idea of yoga is that the rippling of the mind should stand still and be like a quiet pond, and then you'd see the perfect image. So the little fellow looks into the quiet pond. The big fellow, the guru, looks in too. Now, the guru says, "Look at that face. You've got the pot face of a tiger. You're not a goat. You're like me. Be like me." Another silly bleat, but something sinking in. Again, he's picked up by the neck and taken to the tiger's den, where there's a recently killed gazelle, all bloody and nice and yummy. And the big fella takes a big chunk of this stuff and shoves it at the little one. The little one backs away. "I'm a vegetarian," he says. "Come on now," says the big one, and he shoves this stuff down his throat, and he gags on it. And the text says, "As all do on true doctrine." Well, he gags all right, and it gets into his veins and all, and he begins to feel something going buzzing along that he'd never felt before. The right food. And spontaneously, his own tiger nature gets hold of him, and he gives, without even knowing it, a tiger stretch. And a little tiger, I can't call it a roar, but it's something approximating that, enough for the big fellow who knew roars to recognize it as a possibility. The big fellow says, "There we are now. And now we go into the forest and eat tiger food." The moral is that we are all, every one of us, tigers, living among all these goats. And as my students say when I tell them this story, put a tiger in your tank. So.
You've been listening to The World Soul, the fifth talk by Joseph Campbell in the series entitled Inward Journey, East and West. This recording was authorized by the Joseph Campbell Foundation and produced by Electronic Educational Programs. Our theme music is by Acoustic Alchemy. For more information on the work of Joseph Campbell, please call the Foundation at 1-800-330-MYTH, 1-800-330-MYTH. MYTH, or you can contact us on the World Wide Web at jcf.org. I'm Maura Vaughan. Thank you for listening.